Hey Larry, how are you tonight?
Doing fantastic. How are you?
Well, we didn't get a storm. That's probably a good thing.
Well, I have heard that parts of the southeast did get a storm. Sounds like they got an
Yes.
ugly one that's just hovering and hovering and dumping inches and inches of precipitation.
Actually, we should throw this in there. One of our patron supporters messaged me this morning first thing, and I think they may have opened the shelters to registrants, I think.
Yes, we're going to take credit for that at NARSOL for the blistering
For the press
press
release?
release we put out, and it caused that issue to be re-examined. And truthfully, I doubt anyone ever thought about that. This is the problem. This is a great example of what happens when the registrant community is not a part of the debate. When the North Carolina Assembly passed that restriction, the there was one the premises restriction that was declared unconstitutional by the federal court, and then they enacted another one that was even in many ways worse. But the registrant community decided to stay out of the process because it's complicated, and there are people who are afraid that if they go to Raleigh in the capital that it's in the exclusion zone and they would be locked up. And I would doubt that this was ever considered about what to do in a case of an evacuation and an emergency. And if the registrar community had been there saying, well, wait a minute, you can't have this type of ban because what are we going to do in a case of emergencies? Are we going to be banned from using these various shelters that are primarily in school gymnasiums and in public facilities? Or are we going to, if a church opens a shelter, are you going to tell us that we can't go there? I will assure you that those questions were never raised because no one was there raising them.
And that is the perfect segue to bring up the subject again and again and again. What can I do if I can't vote? What if, all of those what ifs, and I can't do because I'm on the registry. All of those things. Here is the example of when whatever this bill was that made it so that registrants can't be in these kind of places, whether that was, hey, you just can't be on school prep property. Why weren't we there to go, hey guys, what happens if? That's
We have
the perfect reason why we need to be active and be in the state capitol.
absolutely, and you can bring up things. I won't guarantee you will win. They
Sure.
may have adopted that premises restriction without any changes, or they may have put a provision in for emergencies. We will never know because we didn't afford them the opportunity to consider something that would not have come up. There would have been no one there from the law enforcement apparatus or from the victims' advocates apparatus to encourage that they provide for a place for registrants to go when they're being evacuated, and that would never have come on anyone's radar. And if you had brought it up and said, hey, well, wait a minute, can we at least carve out an exception? We don't agree with any of this stuff because it's, in our view, unconstitutional. But can you at least let us have shelter in an evacuation at a school? Can you
Sure.
carve out that? Well, they might would have adopted. It's kind of like if you don't play the lottery, if you don't play the horse races, people say, I can't guarantee you'll win, but I can guarantee you won't if you don't. And I can
Yes.
guarantee you that you will not win these battles if you're not there. But I will not guarantee you that you'll win them if you are there.
No, I'm with you, but we can guarantee you won't win if you're not there. Yeah, totally.
I can
What are your
guarantee you
chances of winning?
that the victims' advocates and the law enforcement apparatus will not raise questions on your behalf. I will guarantee you that.
And they are very well represented at these hearings.
Extremely well represented. They are
And
extremely
they're in the
represented.
know. They know all the people. They have the connections. They're already, what's it, like they're intertwined into the whole process.
Absolutely.
And
But
how many states would you say that we have people? So you've got, I'm going to assume Texas with Mary Sue. I'm assuming she's in the know, like you're in your state, et cetera. I'm sure that we have 10 states, maybe, where we're actively represented, maybe.
probably something in that vicinity. Yes, you got Florida, Texas, Illinois. You've got Colorado. You've got clearly California is involved.
Yeah, sure.
But you've got a lot of states where I'd say Oklahoma to some degree is involved. Michigan, but you've got so many states where there's no one doing anything other than praying, and that has not been a successful model either.
Not to go down that rabbit trail of bashing on people that pray.
Not to
Just
go down the
want
rabbit hole, but
to
it's like prayer in and of itself has not proven to be much help in several problems we have in America, including gun violence and on and on and on. I mean, that's what we always do, is extend prayer after these things. But each time we pray, we have another mass shooting. Each time we pray that we're going to be more compassionate towards offenders, that alone hasn't changed public policy. So I would suggest that prayer alone won't fix this.
And why is it acceptable that the guy that sold 85 million pounds of dope and crack and heroin and all that, he's okay to go into the storm shelter and ride it out, or the murderer that has been released? Why are they allowed to go in there? And there's just this particular block of people that can't. Let me rephrase that first. Are we the only block of people that are like explicitly denied access?
That's my understanding. I mean, anyone for a cause could, but as a blanket prohibition, this is the only situation that encounters it. No other shelter. When you go to seek shelter for winter or any mm-hmm. circumstance, any other offender, to my knowledge, is considered based on the merit of how well they behave or the under intoxicants, but not just because of their offense. But the sexual offender, well, we can't have your kind here. And sometimes it's statutory driven. The shelter may be within a zone of exclusion, and the shelter didn't have any control over that. The city councilors or the county commissioners or the state legislators made those restrictions. But don't blame the Adam Walsh Act. They didn't make those restrictions.
And if we roll back to the hurricanes last year, I mean, there were the sheriffs, whatever, in Florida, and they were like flipping, like, if you're a sex offender, don't come here. I will arrest you. You can go hang out of the county jail if you want to.
Yeah, I don't remember that being the case in Texas last year whatever hurricane it was.
Harvey, I believe.
Yeah. Don't believe that being an issue there, but it typically is an issue. Louisiana has a specific statute on how sex offenders are to be segregated, and they get to go on a cattle prod, a cattle haul separate from the regular people,
right,
because they're not the same as regular people. But Narsal, we think we deserve a little bit of credit for sticking our neck out. We got more response on that press release in terms of readership and telephone calls than any press release we have ever done.
And that is from like the media itself or just our people?
Both our media itself. We put it out to the media.
Okay.
And we got
but it got published on the website too. So I'm assuming our people read it.
I'm assuming that, but in terms of the readership among the media, the largest opening rate, the largest number of inquiries that we've ever gotten on a press release.
Do you have any examples that you can share of what that it was?
I can't.
I'm just curious. What, I mean, obviously it was roughly positive. So then do we have any examples of then the media saying, you guys are being inhumane to these people?
Well, we know that we did several interviews as a result.
Okay. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So
awesome.
And we know that a local interview was done with Robin, and we know that we don't know how many phone calls were made saying, hey, what's up? But miraculously, they cleared their and made it possible for people to seek shelter after we acted, and that has never happened before. So kudos to
Yeah, Marshall. No, I think you're right. I think you're right to take at least some shred of credit, if not all of it. I mean, well, it probably wouldn't have happened otherwise, but again, well, we can't touch the negative.
I doubt the victims' advocates did it.
We're back to that.
I doubt the police themselves initiated it, because they were telling people before we did the press release that they were doing robocalls saying that you'll be arrested, in fact.
Jesus. Good grief, dude. Really? I didn't know about that one.
Yeah. There was one of the counties was sending out robocalls saying, if you have to seek evaluation, your kind, you better not go to a shelter, as long as if it's in a school. Or they gave a list of things, and they did robocalls to people.
That's amazing. Wow. All right, then. So, hey, it's okay if you drown, get swept away into the storm and never seen again. That's fine. We could put you over in this place over here. Maybe they could just put a police officer kind of in the corner where they're going to hang out and observe them. But no, they just said F you.
Or maybe, wow. Maybe they could assume that since there's nobody in history that can cite to a sexual offense occurring at a shelter during an emergency, maybe they could just assume that the likelihood is fairly low.
Yeah, but all the people be cuddling their kids going, that's a sex offender over there.
How would they know?
Because we all have it tattooed on our foreheads.
So unless the sex offender says, hey, looky, looky, I'm a sex offender. I just don't know how. I hear all those things about people. I don't know if they think they put out radioactive isotopes or what, but I mean, if you were in a really small community where there was only one shelter, and yes, I could see how it would be possible that they would know. But if you're in an urbanized area and they've got 14, 15 shelters open, and there's hundreds of people in the gymnasium, I just don't know how people would know that you're a sex offender. I don't know how you look any different than anybody else. I'm always struggling on that one. How would they know?
It's funny because then there's an article tonight about that. So let's get going. All right.
All right.
Well, we did get a new patron, and I'd like to thank our new patron this week. Tim, welcome. If you want blue balls, I'll need your address. Send it to me somehow, whether that's email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com, or whatever. And let me say it again. We love your tips and questions. We want to hear what you want us to cover. registrymatterscast@gmail.com is the email, or you can tweet at registrymatters. If you're a Registry Matters patron, by the way, you can message us on patreon.com also. Our patrons are the listeners that make Registry Matters possible. You can gain access to the show early. Generally, I get it done maybe even tonight, Saturday night, but I'll generally release it tomorrow morning sometime. So you get maybe 36 hours early, but you'll also receive other bonuses like blue balls and access to our Discord server. If you're not a patron, we'd love it if you became one. And if you are, thank you so very much for your patronage. You made episode 42 possible, the one you're listening to right now. Keep sending those tips and questions. And hey, if you can spare a moment or two to give us a thumbs up on YouTube or review Registry Matters on iTunes or your favorite podcatcher, we would appreciate it. And thank you so much for listening and supporting Registry Matters. Well, this first article is all over the place. You can find YouTube videos. You can find every article across every publication. But this particular one comes from Variety. And Fox deletes a scene from the reboot of the Predator movie that has a sex offender that is supposedly hitting on the female star of the movie, Olivia Munn, or it's got to be Munn. The reason why I wanted to bring this up since you asked me is because here's a guy that committed an offense. He ends up in a very, very minor scene. He's done his time. He served. I don't know if he's on paper or not. He's been in some other movies, and they cut the scene because he's a sex offender. The reason why I brought it in here is because we can never live past our worst day in history, can we?
It would appear not. And as long as you have the registry, people get mad at me when I say this, the registry is the cancer. If you didn't have the registry, a sex offender wouldn't have the same connotation. They would just be a former criminal. But you have this separate platform that largely is composed of sex offenders. There are some other offender registries, so no one needs to write and say, Larry, you don't understand. They register other people. I do understand that. But most of those registries are relatively benign compared to the sex offender registry.
And they're not criminal in orientation. Well, no, I guess there are. There's like ag assault or animal cruelty ones too, right?
Yes, there's, but those registries generally don't have the same reporting requirements, the same punishment, the same public distribution. You know, like the Arkansas has a child maltreatment registry, and you can be on that registry, but it's not a publicly accessible database to my knowledge. But it will do you harm if you're on that maltreatment registry when you try to do things in life, because you wouldn't be able to be considered because you've maltreated children. But, you know, in the maltreatment of children doesn't have to be a sexual offense. It can be any type of mistreatment of a child.
But as I always bring up the lady from Florida, she's on the registry for not telling the authorities that her kid was having sex. So here she is on the registry. She can't go to a storm shelter. She gets cut from a movie, perhaps.
Well, maybe that's
an extreme example, but
she should have thought about that right before. She didn't,
of course,
call in the police. If your teenager's having sex, I can guarantee you everybody listening to this audience would call the police. I know I would, wouldn't you?
Of course. And then something. So with her, she was saying that her cast members didn't support her decision to out the guy. And so she felt isolated. I didn't really read any of the articles. I just kind of saw some of the headlines of it, that she felt ostracized or isolated because her cast members weren't supporting what she had done in outing the guy. And once she called Fox, they cut the scene from the movie. And I don't know. I just, So yeah, the whole point was to bring it up just because here he is, he's done his time. He's post conviction, whether he's on paper or not, but he gets cut from a movie just because he's on the registry. Mm-hmm. So there you go. Good times. Then moving on to an article from the News and Observer. And oh, hey, you know, I mentioned this recently. We get a lot of articles out of North Carolina, and this one is from Raleigh. And it goes right with, I think last week, maybe 2 weeks ago, somebody didn't report their social media stuff. Here's another guy. Instagram and Snapchat accounts land sex offender in jail. He's 20 years old. He had something happen with a minor like a year or two ago, and he didn't report everything. And he gets locked up again.
Yeah, for his current article, Instagram and Snapchat, which is stuff that I don't access those platforms. So I'm not sophisticated enough to even tell you what people do. I'm assuming when it says Snapchat, I'm assuming you can snap a picture and engage in chat. That seems
like the weirdest platform ever. It's instead of text messaging, you take a goofy picture of your face and you send it to your friend. And somehow that's supposed to communicate a message. I've never understood Snapchat. So Instagram is a photo sharing website.
So you don't actually do text chatting with Snapchat.
You can write messages on it. You can like attach a text to the picture, but it's all about taking pictures. It's very strange. I don't get it. It's not something I understand.
Well, this is a situation where we've talked about it in the case, I think, of Pennsylvania with how many people were getting registry violations.
Yes.
This is a violation of the registry. The 20-year-old, very few 20-year-olds can post a $50,000 bond.
Right.
At that stage of your life, you're usually in your early blooming earnings. You're just beginning to bud as a wage earner. And your savings is minimal in most cases. And the person doesn't have the collateralization. They haven't accumulated equity of sufficient nature. So they end up sitting in jail. Somebody down in North Carolina needs to say to the prosecutor's office, what the hell is wrong with you people? We're spending tens of thousands of dollars to prosecute this guy and to house him and to possibly send him to state prison because it is a felony that can land him in prison. What the hell is wrong with you people? He didn't report a social media. That is nothing that puts the public in extreme jeopardy. We should incarcerate people in this country that are danger to us. This is because they're mad at him. He's got a sexual offense or whatever nature. He's probably had sex with an underage person when there was too great of an age difference, whatever that might be in North Carolina. But we're mad at him, and we're going to teach him a lesson at the tomb. You conservatives, wake up out there. This is an example of what you need to be railing about, because this is wasteful money if I've ever heard of any. What do you think?
Well, it says failure to report new online identifiers is a felony, and he's being held in lieu of $50,000 bail. So like you said, he can't get it. I mean, he might have to post $5,000 bond or whatever if it's 12%, whatever. So yeah, he's being held to the tune of hundreds of dollars per day because he didn't report a couple things on social media. And he's 20 years old. What are 20-year-olds doing? They are all over Snapchat and Instagram.
Well, and the funny thing is, This information probably didn't fall out of the sky. They probably did this by spending a lot of hours to track him, to figure out. So there's detectives working around the clock trying to get a violation. They want an I got you moment, and they're spending all that money. So nobody's asking them, and what the hell are you doing with our law enforcement resources? I thought crime was over the top and this was the most dangerous country on earth and we didn't do something. Why are you sitting in there trying to track this guy down who has an Instagram and Snapchat, whatever the hell they are, account, not out and doing some real police work? Those questions are not being asked, I'm certain. But if those questions were being asked and the phones were ringing off the hook in the Wake County District Attorney's office and people were demanding answers, they would not be doing this prosecution.
So there you go. And when he was questioned about it, he just said, I forgot to tell you about him.
Well, and he may have forgotten and he may have,
of course,
blown it off. But if you want this information, you have to make it easy for it to be reported. We're in the modern society.
We do live in a digital age where you could create a very simple form online for them to fill it out.
Where they can go online and report it and upload it. And some states do that.
Right. I think I've heard of them. NARSOL can.
Does it? You got like 6 hours to report a creation of a new online identifier.
Good grief. 6 hours.
But you can report online. If you have it online at Interfire, you probably have access to the internet, I would hope.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, you know, Narsal can take membership right there online, and, you know, we can take new patrons right there online. This is essentially not different. They're making a barrier to entry for people to do it, to look for a way to jam you up.
That's my opinion.
I hear you. And then, so moving on to the next article that we have, where it's from the Tennessean, and America must face and fix its unjust prison system. It goes along with something very similar to what we've been talking about for many, many months now, of we lock up too many people. It costs so much money. One of the quotes of the article, it says, "Our great embarrassment as a civilized nation is our prison system."
Yes, that is a great embarrassment to those. Now, you got to remember, Andy, a lot of people believe that America is perfect at everything it does, and that the rest of the country, the rest of the world should emulate this nation in all of their policies. So we won't reach those people who have that belief. But there are people, hopefully listening to this podcast, that realize that America doesn't do everything perfectly. And we are actually the laughingstock of the world, the civilized world, when it comes to how many people we incarcerate, what we incarcerate people for, how long we incarcerate them, and how we disregard all attempts to rehabilitate them and make them a better human being. The civilized world laughs at America. And they shake their head saying, how can a great country like America be so naive as to pursue policies that are so destructive? But we continue to do it.
Would you say that just taking someone's liberty is sufficient to be the punishment?
It should be. That should be the punishment. And progressive sheriffs and prison wardens do take that attitude. Now, they don't have oftentimes control over the facilities that they're handed to house people in. Very few sheriffs formulate their own budget for building their own jail and do their own design plans and decide their own staffing levels and what sort of rehabilitation programs. But there are a lot of people who hold that attitude that their confinement is the punishment. And we're not here to inflict additional punishment. But there's a lot of people who run prison administrators and wardens and sheriffs who don't take that attitude. And they take great satisfaction, and they take the cue from the American people who want them to suffer.
Yeah, Joe Arpaio.
Joe Arpaio, and there's plenty like Joe. Joe took it to an extreme,
right?
But there are plenty of people that are similar to Joe in terms of wanting prisoners to suffer as much as possible.
And I'm trying to build a model in my head of describing this. So taking away your liberty means you can't go to the local pizza joint, you can't go watch a movie, you can't go turn on Netflix. What should perhaps prison look like if we're only taking away your liberty? I mean, you could kind of take away somebody's liberty and give them house arrest, I think.
Well, you could.
That would be at least some of your liberties removed, and you're not necessarily in a ridiculously hostile environment with shitty food.
You could do that, but that doesn't satisfy the thirst. Watch when a person gets a creative sentence that doesn't send them to prison. Watch the howls and protest in the media about that person. Did just remember Brock Turner? He only got 70 days in jail.
Yep,
70 days. And of course,
yeah, but lifetime registration.
Yeah, lifetime. Yeah. Well, it could be lifetime, maybe not, depending on what state he lives in. But there's howls of protest about it never being enough. And it's never enough because that's who we are as a people. Right. And I keep going back to us. When we start blasting our elected officials with emails, phone calls, and questions at public events and saying, you do not represent my values. I do not want people sentenced to life in prison. I do not want long prison sentences. I want rehabilitation. And of course, if I'm an elected official, I'm going to ask you, well, now, are you willing to pay the taxes? Because it costs more to the security can be diminished. The security component of incarceration could be diminished, arguably, if you had more programming, because you would have less emphasis on trying to figure out how to keep people. The reason why people try to circumvent things is because they got plenty of free time on their hands. But you'd still have an increased cost for programming, because good programming costs money. And if you want that, I've got to, unless I'm with the federal government, I don't have to tax you. I can balloon the deficit like they're doing now. But if most states and most counties have to run a balanced budget. And therefore, you need to be able to, with the citizens, if they do ever come around to that point of view, then they have to also be willing to put their money up to do to pay the taxes for rehabilitation. And some will say, well, if you just simply spend the money you're now doing on rehabilitation, but that model doesn't work, it breaks down because the people that run the system now are not going to, they're not going to say we can cut security. They're not going to say, oh, well, you're right. I've got 1,500 guards. I can go down to 700 and I'll have money. That doesn't work like that. They will tell you they don't have enough for security as it is.
So it's I can attest to that. I mean, they're not running yard call as much as they should in Georgia because they don't have enough guards on staff to handle the load.
So
they say. And we have another article coming up that's related to this. And then in combination with that, along with the low unemployment, you have a situation in the United States right now where unemployment is really low, but you also have a massive skills gap where you have people that, let's just say, they know how to do manufacturing jobs, but the manufacturing jobs aren't here. We're moving more towards a technology and service culture, but they're not trained at that. And I'm not saying that people should go to prison and get a, you know, it shouldn't be their alternate path to get a college degree, but it doesn't seem like it would be that hard to get those kind of training programs to whatever the economy demands. Go to like the Department of Labor website. Here are the top 10 jobs for the next 10 years or something like that. Why can't the prisons focus on that kind of programming to get people out of prison that they could then go work in a field that has demand?
Well, they could if that's what the people demand.
We're back to us. Every when you point at somebody, there's three fingers pointing back. That's what the answer is.
And that's what I'm always going to do until the program either folds or people actually start taking those steps. The people who represent you need to hear that they're not representing your values as far as they believe they are. But yes, we could do that. We could take the top 10 jobs and we could integrate vocational training into prisons and even college courses. We could. Those things would cost money. But if we demanded that, we could have that.
But we don't demand it, so we don't. And we keep punishing people and putting our foot on their necks.
We want them to suffer. And by golly, I had to work and send myself to night school. And right? I didn't have all this handed to me. And why the heck should I work and pay taxes for these losers who've broken the rules to go to prison and live a cushy life? And it's just not right. And by golly, I'm not going to support it. And that's the attitude we have.
Yep.
By and large.
I was having a conversation with my handler about parts of this, and he was telling me that he goes to so many of his other probies' houses, and they're just sitting there playing Xbox all day. And he's like, why do I have to spend my tax dollars to support that loser? And I don't know that I agree with that our tax dollars should support someone to just sit at home and play Xbox all day. But at the same time, there's probably a reason why the person thinks that that's the acceptable way that they should live in this society.
Well, which tax dollars are supporting? What person can sit at home and do Xbox? I didn't know we had a social safety net that would allow people to sit at home. What program they're on.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that question. I didn't ask him that.
Okay,
that's what he says.
Well, for a Social Security disability, you have to have a disability to collect that. That's a form of a social safety net, but it's not open to everybody. You have to have worked and paid in SSI, Supplemental Security Income. It will provide disability payments for those who are aged, blind, or disabled, but you have to have an eligibility for that. Temporary assistance to needy families, you have to have a child, and that has a five-year lifetime cap, along with work requirements to be eligible if they have children between certain ages or exempt. I think a child may be under 4 or 5 when they're not in school. If you have a child, you're exempt from those. But food stamps for able-bodied, there's like a three-month period where they exempt. Then they have to engage in work requirements. I would just like to know what program we have in America. Please enlighten me, listeners. What allows a person without a disability, which tax dollars support them to just sit home and play Xbox? Because I'd like to sign up for it myself.
Then he believes that person is collecting some sort of assistance that allows him to do that, and he thinks it's coming out of his check when there's income coming from somewhere else, whether he's just bumming living off of somebody else. But there are at 25 years old, it's going to be really hard to get some sort of social safety net to just sit at home. Otherwise, a person would be homeless, right?
Well, I went through the litany of programs we have in America, and none of those would qualify. Temporary assistance needy families, you have to have a dependent child. You don't get that as a single. Right. Right. Food stamps you can get as a single. It's like $194 a month maximum payment, but then there's a requirement that able bodies have to engage in either work training or real work to be eligible.
Well, you've heard that complaint before that there are all kinds of Americans that are sitting at home on their ass all day doing nothing.
Well, they are in fact sitting on their ass doing nothing, but that doesn't mean that they're collecting taxpayers. It may be that they're living off of a parent. It may be they're living off of other sponging off of relatives, but it doesn't mean just because they're sitting at home doesn't mean they're living off you, does it?
No, it totally doesn't mean that. I didn't have the argument framed on the other side when he brought this up.
I wouldn't advise you to bring that up to the PO. I was kind of kidding because that might create a hostile relationship with a PO. But
whatever. I can take him on. I can beat him. I'm just kidding.
But yeah, when I hear that usually comes from a person who has a more conservative view on life, and sometimes they don't really understand the limitations of our social safety net. Actually, in America, we have of the civilized world, again, one of the weakest social safety nets of the civilized world. We have a hodgepodge of programs that everyone's not eligible for universally. The only thing universally that are people eligible for, and even that's not universal anymore because the conservatives keep putting all the restrictions on food stamps, which is in the farm bill. I think we're going to get to later where they're to expand the restrictions on food stamps even further. But other than that, we don't have a general social safety net in the United States of America. I hate to burst your bubble. You might wish we did or think we do, but we don't.
Well. And so let's move on to the article. And this is, I didn't realize that this was a year and a half old article, but it's from the American Psychological Association. And the question is, should registered sex offenders be banned from social media? And the subtitle is, restricting sex offenders' access to social media may increase their societal exclusion, undermining efforts to reintegrate them into society. And my comment would be, if our objective is to have low recidivism rates and that then makes them pay taxes to support these other social safety net programs and, you know, pay taxes to support the schools and the roads and all those things. Why is social media some sort of like mythical taboo place? And there's, like in this particular case, there's mountains of evidence to say that this is not the best of ideas. This is, I think you say, failed public policy. Or misguided public policy, that we would restrict people from using the internet where they could make connections with people. Yes, they could potentially make connections with people that they shouldn't be, like minors. But you could go do that at Walmart if you were really intent upon doing that. So I'm just baffled why you would restrict people from the internet.
Well, the Supreme Court expressed the same frustrations in Packingham, and in particular for those who had completed the service of their sentence, which is what we talk about a lot at NARSOL, because those people presumably have full restoration of most of their rights. And the Supreme Court expressed that in terms of being able to participate in society, not so much as far as building social bonds, but society in terms of dissent and participation of voters, access to information, public forums. They equated it to being the town square, you know, of yesteryear. Why we have this, again, goes back to the people. There are a few people who clamor for this type of restriction. And there's very little opposition when these things are debated because the sex offenders are never represented. We don't have the money and the ability to be in the capitals. And the victims' advocates and the law enforcement apparatus are not going to speak in favor of what we would like for them to take the positions we would like to take. Until we get a bunch of money from the Koch brothers or some other rich club, we're not going to be able to really fight back. This is totally misguided. It's contrary to sound public policy. I mean, it's nuts, but hopefully the Packingham decision made it clear that blanket bans are not permissible, but they did leave the door open to narrowly tailored bans, meaning that possibly the right social media platforms could be prohibited from people who had proclivities, which doesn't mean the entire registry population. It may mean people who have targeted minors in their crimes, and then it would be certain media platforms. They did leave that door open, to a narrow, much more narrowly tailored ban. But I think what we got from them is clearly you just can't ban everybody from social media. That unless you're the social media themselves doing it, but the government
right.
can't do it.
Which pretty much all of them do have a clause in there that says you can't be on us if you have one of these kind of convictions.
And that was a result of public pressure. There was a time yes. in Facebook's history that they said, we welcome all comers. And then mm-hmm. there was a barrage of bad negative news coverage about, can you believe that a responsible company like Facebook would allow sex offenders to be online and trolling for our minors? And the public outcry got too much for them, and they decided that they would play ball and that they would put the policies in place. But they initially had open to all.
Well, I don't remember what you said a few minutes ago about people living in your community that are sex offenders, but this article comes from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Heartland residents want to ban sex offenders from living near their kids. And there are 30 sex offenders living in Heartland. Several of them live near schools and parks. And I have a clip to play for this.
Learned about it.
Peter Walker says it was the Heartland police alerting them to a new sex offender getting placed in the area that started everything.
This guy's crimes were especially disgusting and got the attention of a lot of parents. He was placed right next to a bus stop. So there's kids planted pretty much right outside his door 5 days a week.
After a bit of digging, Walker discovered Heartland is one of the few communities that does not have any restrictions on where sex offenders can live.
The fact that you have, in some cases, sex offenders living adjacent to daycares, adjacent to parks, right out of their backyard, they have a park. That's silly.
Walker started a petition that's now garnered more than 800 signatures. The village president tells me he had no idea there wasn't an ordinance in place before and thinks that could have something to do with the reason so many sex offenders live in Heartland.
Based on the numbers that I see, it appears that it's very easy for the state to bring them here. What I do know is that we're here right now, and now we all know that there isn't an ordinance on the books. And we need to create an ordinance. It's the best thing to do for the village and for the residents.
Well, Caroline, with that in mind, is there a timeline to change the rules?
Patrick, the village president tells me that he's hoping to create that ordinance, hopefully within the next month or so, that would restrict where future sex offenders can be placed in their area.
All right, Caroline Reinwald reporting live from the newsroom tonight.
All right. They didn't know they were there beforehand, so they weren't drumming up any sort of, there wasn't a conga line of kids missing. They didn't know they were there. So here, now we are creating a solution to a non-existent problem.
Well, it's the problem that they have in Wisconsin, and fortunately we don't have that problem, but the problem they have in Wisconsin is they don't have any statewide preemption on local ordinances. And as more and more communities have said, we will have an ordinance because it makes us feel good. It compresses the places where the offenders can locate, and it makes it more and more difficult. And then it increases pressure on other elected officials, like you just heard from the local officials there in Heartland, that they need to do something because they don't want the 31 to grow to 61, to grow to 91. And this is a suburb of Milwaukee, and I think I can pronounce Waukesha County is the name of the county that we're in.
I hope you got that right.
And the suburb is only 9,000 people, and it's 5 square miles, so it's a very small place. It'd be hard to imagine that you would be able to live in a place that wouldn't be close to something, because everything mm-hmm. is close to something in a compact community like this. But I can understand. The frustration that they're feeling, because when you don't know any better, which I give the parents the benefit of the doubt, they don't know that they're not in an elevated state of danger. You're living next to a school, but people are near kids all the time. The only time they're not near kids is when they're locked up in some type of facility. But if you have no residency or proximity restrictions, or if you have residency or proximity restrictions, you're still going to encounter kids in the course of a day, period.
Yeah. And you just avoid them, and many of the people that are living there don't have a crime related to kids.
There won't be a soul in opposition at the city council in all likelihood.
Oh, you're right.
And this will be non-contested, and it'll pass, they'll pass an ordinance. And they already mentioned in the article that they don't intend to try to make it retroactive, but they want to close the floodgate. They want to close the floodgate, what they perceive as a potential floodgate, because the Department of Corrections, as they have fewer and fewer communities where they can locate people in, they're afraid that the Department of Corrections is going to locate more and more people upon release from prison to Heartland, and that's not what they want.
The answer is
to prohibit local communities from doing what they're doing. That is the answer, because otherwise it's a never-ending competition.
Is that the thing that happened in Texas, say, 3 years ago, where the towns like smaller than 5,000 people were going to try and make their own rules, and that was being fought? I think they eventually won, but they were contested in the middle. Is that the same kind of situation?
Kind of, but it'd be more simple, similar to California than Texas. Texas had home rule cities, and they have the general law cities. Mm-hmm. The population less than 5,000 is a general law city. And they had chosen not to give general law cities the same powers that they give home rule cities. And there's a number of reasons for that. Of course, a city of 5,000 or less, you're not going to have a lot of sophisticated resources to do things you would have in the larger cities. But the without the general law cities having that authority, there was a challenge that said you can't impose these restrictions in small towns. And the court agreed. They said you have no such authority. Then a bill overturned that by changing the law to give the small cities that power. And everybody brought in their recidivism statistics and how residency restrictions were flawed, and they took their eye off the ball. I mean, they put up a gallant effort, and they did a great job containing this bill in committee. And we spent an entire podcast explaining how they actually got it out through another vehicle, how they got it out of committee. But they did a great job. They surprised me bottling up in committee. But then the debate turned when the bill was hijacked. And I'll just say the bill got added to another bill and what we would politically refer to as a hijacking. And then they continued to try to use the argument that residency restrictions were ineffective. But the argument no longer was that. The argument was, why should home rule cities have powers that people – so the lawmakers in Austin were facing telling their constituents, well, the cities like Amarillo, they can have these, Dallas and San Antonio, but by golly, if you happen to live in a small town, you're not allowed to protect yourself, by golly, against these sex offenders. Now, how come it's good for the big cities and it ain't good for the small towns? How come our families don't deserve to be safe? That's what the argument turned to. And they weren't able to shift gears and go quickly enough into why home rule cities are entitled and have been given broader powers. That was their argument, that they kind of they stayed with the argument that they had used successfully about it being ineffective. And that was no longer the question. The question before the assembly was whether or not they were going to give small towns the same powers that larger cities had. And they ultimately said, yes, we will. And so now any city in Texas can have residency restrictions.
Classic moving the goalpost.
Yes, it is. And preemption can occur by statutory scheme or by court a determination. If you can make a credible argument that there should be state preemption, and depending on whether or not you have an activist court or not, sometimes you'll get a decision saying, sorry, there's state supremacy. But that's only two ways you could. We did it by state statute here. There's state preemption, but I think we're the only state that's done it. I think Kansas has state preemption, but I think that was done a long time ago, possibly at the time they formed created registration to begin with. I'm not absolutely sure on that, but I know that we did state preemption here. But most are fighting this. California did it through a judicial decision. I think Pennsylvania achieved it through a judicial decision. Massachusetts. There's a number of states where the state's highest courts have said that the state is supreme, and you can't do anything that the state doesn't have in the register statute.
Interesting. Moving on to an article that comes, I think this is coming out of Washington State. It was actually kind of hard. I was looking up, like, the name of the county is Cowlitz. But there's a guy up there that wants to take level one sex offenders and publish their names, which is pretty awesome. There's this dude named Curtis Hart who is planning on releasing the names of 570 people and release them on the internet of his own volition, which I think is just amazing. And we should cheer and rally behind this guy.
Oh, well, now. All righty.
He's made it clear that if you're like kind of a Romeo and Juliet situation, he's probably not going to do it. So now he's just looking for the ones that are actual quote unquote predators. I'm trying to figure out, where does he get the authority to determine who is and who isn't?
Well, I didn't read that article, but I can tell you that's been a constant battle. What state is this out of?
I'm pretty sure this is out of Washington State.
Yeah, because that battle's been going on in Washington State for a while. There's a court decision that says that even though the registry itself doesn't release you publicly through its dissemination vehicle, that the public records laws of Washington make that information available because it's on file with local law enforcement and it's a releasable document. Well, so what's happening is that they're using that as an end run around to get the information. And then they'll say, well, it isn't the state publishing it. Don't get mad at them.
Yeah. And that's that they covered that in the article, that he has filed a request with his county, whatever, and they're trying to do what they can to comply and not release too much, blah, blah, blah. But so here this jackass is, and now you've got all the registrants in that area calling in trying to file injunctions and so forth to keep them from being able to release it. But once it gets released, even if he gets charged with the whatever kind of crime he would get charged with for doing it, the information's out there and you can't do anything about it.
And I think that's how Luke Heimlich, the Oregon State baseball player, I believe that he was not listed publicly because his conviction rose from when he was a juvenile. But the fact that he was still registered allowed this unearthing of his registration, and then it went public and it exposed Oregon State University to the fact that they had a convicted sex offender who was still registering. Attending and playing and traveling around the country. And that's when it got ugly. And then I didn't ever think he'll play pro baseball, and he got passed up in the draft. And unless there's a major change in public attitude, I don't think he'll play in American pro baseball. But
he got passed up by a Japanese team too.
Yeah. It's just in America, it'd be a perpetual distraction. And we're kind of going down a rabbit hole here off of this, mm-hmm. but I think this is how it got, his information got out there, was through the same vehicle.
But okay.
It would be a perpetual distraction. If you got a baseball management, and please, this is not me, I'm putting myself in their shoes as if I were them, because I know we're going to get emails. But if you're running a baseball team, your primary objective is to put as many fans in the seat and gobble up as many beer and hot dogs as you possibly can. You're not thinking about how to manage through a line of protesters when the team lands at the airport in a city, trying to figure out how you're going to deal with all the victims' advocates saying this guy doesn't deserve to make money. It would be a perpetual distraction. And they're in the baseball business. They're in the spectator enjoyment of fans. And this would be a distraction that I can't imagine that any owner would want to engage in. And that's why he didn't get picked for a team. It would just be too much of a distraction for anybody to bear. Is it the right thing to do? No, it's not the right thing to do. But that's the reality of the business decision that was made, is that we don't want this distraction around.
And then because of all that, he's not going to have a $5 million a year paycheck. And now a team in Japan has passed him up. So now he's just going to go flip burgers at McDonald's.
And we're better off as a society somehow for that.
I'm with you. Sounds good to me. Just like the guy that's going to release all that information. We are better if he does it.
He's actually going to hurt a lot of people who are... I guess I could roll back, but I know we've got some listeners in Nebraska, and hello, Hank, thank you. We've got listeners in Nebraska, and they were people who suffered and are still suffering enormously when they flipped their registry from law enforcement only for the bulk of the registrants to public for everybody. There are people who held well-paying jobs, who were paying lots of taxes, and one of them, I bring it up from time to time, was a mid-level supervisor, I believe, at ConAgra Foods, and he was pushing a shopping cart around Omaha last time I heard. And we're proud of ourselves now that we're not collecting any taxes, and we're trying to figure out where he is. And of course, I would argue his recidivism chances of committing some other criminal being engaged in future criminality have gone up as a result of them disclosing everybody's information. Well, that's what this man's doing here. He's going to take people that are level one and level two that are not being disseminated publicly, and he's going to ruin their lives because he's angry and because of whatever reasons he's got. I can't speak for his motivations, but it sounds like he's angry, and he gets to ruin people's lives because he's angry and he doesn't agree with public policy. The citizens of Washington made the registry through their elected representatives not to disclose everybody's information, and he's doing an end run around to disclose it despite the will of the people, and he's going to get away with it. It's already been proven that the courts have said he has the right to that information, and he has the right to publicize it. So here we go.
Yep. Well, then moving on to an article that is from NewJersey.com, NJ.com. And this is an article titled, New Jersey Congresswoman, 10 Things We Need to Do to Fix the U.S. Prison Problem. And like I said, so this is Representative Bonnie Watson Coleman, and she represents the 12th District. She listed 10 things, and I really just want to focus on three of them there at the bottom of the list. Number 8, state prisons must be funded specifically to offer more rehabilitation services. We already talked about that we as a people don't want them to do it, but if they had more programs, then when they got out, they would have a better chance of getting a job and more chance of not recidivating and so forth. Number 9 is Pell Grants must be reinstated in all states and territories. And the last one, the voting rights of all confined citizens serving prison sentences, pretrial detainees, and so-called ex-felons must be counted. Representation is demanded. All voices count. So I guess that's the prison gerrymandering concept that we've talked about recently.
Yes. And this is a darn liberal, do-good Democrat.
Bastards.
Thrown out of office talking such craziness.
Do you have an opinion on whether people actually incarcerated should be allowed to vote?
Well, I do have an opinion, but I see possibly some logistical problems for it. I mean, you generally set up polling. I can't imagine they're going to want prisoners to leave the prison to vote on election day. I suspect that's.
But why couldn't you do an absentee ballot?
You could. You could do that, I suppose. But I can see some logistical problems. But there's a couple of states, I think Maine and Vermont.
Yes, we've covered that. It's up there in New England.
That do not disenfranchise people. Now, it would be worthwhile for us to look into how they actually effectuate the process and how the ballots are done, because I'm reasonably certain they don't let them out on election day.
I'm trying to think of the pros and cons. I mean, is there a reason why you shouldn't be allowed to vote? You're still a citizen. You still deserve some kind of representation. You know, the policies that they're going to throw down that affect the prison system, obviously that's going to directly impact you. I can see why you would, but here you are incarcerated. I can kind of, it feels good to say that you shouldn't be allowed to vote.
Well, we can do a little bit of research to bolster this and bring it back maybe next week. But I think there's a fear that it would alter the election landscape. And the example would be the in Coalinga, California, where they put people who are in civil commitment. Most people were eligible to vote, but last I heard, there was an effort underway to strip them, that their voter registration would be at the last place they lived before they were committed, rather than in the town of Coalinga, because they were disproportionately affecting the outcome of elections, because they were actually voting, and it kind of made the city fathers mad that they voted down some sort of tax increase, and they looked at the margin, and the margin was at about less than what the number of people were that were eligible to vote that were at the Coalinga, however they pronounce it, state hospital. And I think that would bear some comparison to I mean, if you prisons tend to be on the large side in America. We don't have too many 100-person prisons. You know, there are many hundreds, over 1,000 people in a typical prison. And they're typically out in the boonies, which would be a small county. You got a county of 9,000 people, 3,000 of them registered to vote. I'm guessing out of typical registration ratios, you got the children that are not old enough to vote, and you got of the adult population. So you got 3,000 registered to vote. You got 1,000 adults in prison. That could be a significant impact if they voted in that community's election. I suspect that probably plays into it a little bit as well.
So now all of a sudden whatever team it is, red or blue, so now it's going to go red or blue based on the people in prison, and could sway that election, and you could flip over, you could have an entire state determined because of those handful of counties that are big prison populations.
Well, yeah, and it could and it could backfire, because the rural areas where prisons are located typically tend to be conservative areas politically.
Right.
And
Hang on. Is it almost designed then to move the populations out there, remove them from the left leaning areas, move them into a right leaning area where they can't vote?
I'm not saying that, but I'm thinking that there's a fear that they would vote left wing, and I don't see that. I see, as our podcast audience is largely conservative. I see a lot of people who are in prison, when you engage them, they are very conservative. I think the conservatives will actually benefit from those votes. But I don't think they know that. I think they
Why do you think they would benefit?
Because they tend to vote, they tend to be very conservative. Think about when you were in prison. Think about how many people were, when you talk to, if they talk politics, about how conservative they are. Like I say, our audience is overwhelming. I've been to so many conferences and engaged hundreds and hundreds of people. And no matter how many I engage, I typically get a conservative viewpoint on most everything. and I have a feeling that within the prison population, although I have never served prison time, I have a feeling that there's a lot more conservatism than people think. And I think that the fact that they are prisoners, I think people would fear that they're going to vote for lefties. But I have a feeling they actually wouldn't vote for lefties.
It might just be a wash. It might just kind of balance out, you know, and be kind of a neutral thing. You just have a whole bunch of more votes, but it didn't change the outcome necessarily.
Well, I believe they voted against the tax increase, so that tells you that the people in Coalinga were not a bunch of lefties wanting to impose more taxes. I believe, if I got the story right, that it was something that the town wanted to do, and they voted. The margin of loss of the referendum of the public vote was less than what they had in the state hospital. Hmm. But like I said, we could bring that back to a future podcast and explore it further.
There was an article in PBS.org talking about low unemployment means a criminal record is less of a hurdle. I do have a little anecdotal story. A friend of mine, he got laid off from a job for completely unrelated reasons, more like personal reasons. And he recently found a job that looks like it's up in the northeast portion of the state. And it's for a good amount of money. And he told them his situation. They said, come on in, we don't care. But here we go. I mean, unemployment is pretty low, as you know, historically speaking. And because of that, then a company that needs to put a body in a job, they're going to have fewer and fewer restrictions on whether you got like a big grill of gold and stuff in your teeth or bad breath, or if you have a conviction of some kind, that they'll may still hire you.
That is the reality of the situation. We've been at low unemployment in the 4% range for a number of years now. And the employers are becoming a little more tolerant of failed drug tests, a little more tolerant of people who have a criminal history. I don't know how much tolerance they're given for people on the registry, because they perceive a civil liability there if something goes wrong. But the tolerance for people from employers for people who have convicted offenders has certainly gone up. There's no question about that.
There's an interesting little quote here in this article. It says, about the same number of Americans have criminal records as have college degrees. I'd never heard it placed that way.
Mm-hmm. That is a
crazy. So, I mean, so like a third of Americans have some kind of involvement with law enforcement. Is that too high?
That sounds about right. Arrest record. You may not have a conviction, but a heck of a number of Americans have criminal histories of some type.
So I just wanted to bring this out. So, hey, if you're one of our people, now's a good time to go get a job. That's pretty much what I wanted to get out of that.
I think your odds are a lot better now than they were 5 years ago, 8 years ago, when we had the economic collapse in 2008.
Yeah.
And then for the first couple of years when we were digging out of all the cataclysmic decline that we had, it was very difficult for people to get a job. But since
it was good times.
Yeah, 2015-16, the unemployment rate has fallen to historical lows. When you're in the 4% range, we're in 3.94, 4.1. We've been in the 4.5% range for some time now. And it's very tough finding people. And I have said before, there are acute and extreme labor shortages in this country.
Yep. They're just in areas where we don't have the skill set to handle it.
Yeah. Builders are just flat on their back trying to find people, and they're poaching from each other. They're poaching from one another.
Yeah.
And some high tech jobs are going unfilled because they can't get enough specialized visas admitted. And then of course the lower end is always the part that suffers when you do service industries like hotels and quick service restaurants. Those people, there's a help wanted sign billboard in every fast food establishment in every metro area, except for maybe really depressed areas like Gary, Indiana, or East St. Louis, Missouri. You don't find a lot of jobs in those really rotting, decaying communities. But in urban settings now, it's hard not to find work if you want work.
Right.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
The next one, this goes past my understanding. It's a law case, Doe versus Baum, out of Michigan, I guess it is. And it was a freshman and a junior, and the guy's the junior, and at a frat party, drinking, and then they have sex. She says she didn't want it. He says she did. She files a sexual misconduct complaint, and the college gets involved and starts investigating. They interview like 24 people, and all of the male witnesses corroborated the guy's story, and all the female witnesses corroborated the female story. And I think the crux of the article, I think it is, it says the Sixth Circuit reversed the dismissal of John's suit against the university because he didn't have the opportunity to cross-examine the accuser. It's very much over my head.
That's not over your head at all. That's exactly what this case was about. And I'm starting to like the Sixth Circuit a little bit more because that's the same circuit where Doe's versus Snyder came from. And I'm not well enough versed on the judges on that court because these cases are always decided by 3-judge panels. And so I don't know of which persuasion and who appointed them or any of that kind of stuff. I'd have to do more research. But I can tell you that they came down solidly on a constitutional bedrock principle of confrontation. And the university did not provide that confrontation in their administrative process. Now, remember, this is not the criminal prosecution. This is determining whether he should remain enrolled at the university. And they would not allow him to confront the accuser. And that has been a policy, one of the policies of the previous administration that I have some consternation with. And I've voiced some approval for this administration trying to roll back that we've gone too far on the due process where the accused is being deprived of due process. And if we're going to call ourselves the United States of America and hold ourselves out as a beacon to the world about what due process is, we can't just jettison it for convenience. Yes, it can be traumatic if you have been a victim to have to relive it, but that's the design of our system. The person who's, in case of a criminal proceeding, the freedom you're trying to take away. But in this proceeding, his opportunity for an education was going to be taken away without him being so as much as being heard in the process. And the Sixth Circuit said, nope, you can't do that. They dismissed his case on a motion for summary judgment. And this is a great read because it goes through about that the lawsuit on dismissal, the complaint is presumed true. Everything is resolved in favor of the complaint being valid until you've had a trial. And the state said we don't need a trial because we didn't need to give him due process. We had the right to believe her, and the university said that's our position. And the court said, well, no, you don't have the right to believe her without any due process. He has the right to be heard. Maybe her allegations will be proven in some kind of proceeding to be credible. But at this point, we have to assume that his version, because he's the complainant here, he filed the lawsuit. We have to assume and resolve all the inferences in his favor, and he deserves his day in court. So they reinstated the lawsuit that had been dismissed by the district judge, so it remained with instructions to go forward, and he can move forward with his lawsuit.
Is there a term for the person that files a suit? Is there something that says that they have like the teeniest little bit of an advantage since they're the one making the claim that the other side has to defend it? Is there some sort of terminology here that I'm not quite expressing?
No, he doesn't have any advantage whatsoever other than when you say, I shouldn't have to face this lawsuit, it should be dismissed. The court has to look at that complaint on its face and assume it's true until it's been tested in court. All the inferences are resolved in favor of the complaint. And since the university didn't see any fit to have any due process, none of this was tested.
Okay.
But he doesn't have any advantage. He just has the right to be heard.
Right. But even inside of that whole situation, he was facing expulsion, so he agreed to withdraw from the university, and he was only 13 and a half credits shy of graduating.
Yeah, I caught that. Yes.
It's garbage. Garbage.
And like I say, the previous administration went too far in the due process for colleges to follow. This administration seems to be on track towards bringing it back to the proper balance, closer to the proper balance.
Hang on. Did you just say something good about the current administration?
Yeah, I said it last week also.
Hang on. I got to mark that down on my calendar. All right.
It's hard to find a lot to give people credit for, but I'm about good public policy. And I would give this administration as much credit as I could if I agreed with them on most of the public policies that they're pursuing. I don't, but I do agree on this one.
Yes. So, I'm just poking fun at you.
Right. But I'm just letting the listeners know that it's not about Democrat versus Republican. I can be harsh on Democrats and frequently am. I can be harsh on Trump because I disagree with many of his policies.
And I didn't agree with everything
that President Obama did.
No, of course not. That seems to be like one of the fundamental issues. It's like, I'm team red, I'm team blue, I hate you just because of the team, and I can't like anything that you do because you're not on my team. It's completely tribal, and it's like, well, wouldn't you rather have this? Well, that makes perfect sense. Well, the other team introduced it. I hate it. What? It doesn't make any sense.
Doesn't, but that's where we are, and there are people who are willing to forgive all sorts of transgressions because he's our guy. And that I don't see it that way. I try to be a little more objective and call it the way I see it. This administration, when I agree with them, I will publicly proclaim that.
I had an email conversation with someone the other day, and I think I told you about it. But one of the things that the person brought up was that she believes that Obama was a Muslim. And I've heard the claim a bazillion times. I have nothing to back up how anybody thinks that he is. Never saw him wearing a kufi, going to any sort of Muslim style prayer, Islam prayers. I don't know where it comes from. So now you hate the guy just because he's a Muslim? And shouldn't we be blind to what the person's religion is? Like John F. Kennedy, there are quotes. He's like, hey, yeah, I'm a Catholic, but that shouldn't matter. I'm interested in advancing the United States. And I'm just baffled when someone makes that claim to me.
Yeah. And the funny thing is the people who make that claim, of course, there's nothing to support it. But had Obama not released his taxes, they would have said, and see, he's hiding those connections. He's hiding them. Well, this president broke a 40-plus year tradition of releasing taxes, although he said during the campaign, I'm under audit and I will release them after the audit's complete. And then, of course, when he got elected, he said, I'm not actually going to release them. But they would have been criticizing him and say he was hiding something. Had he taken the position that he wouldn't release his taxes. Amazingly, they're stone silent about this president not releasing his taxes. So I asked the question, what is he hiding? I haven't seen his birth certificate either. Yeah, he went on for years about Obama's birth certificate. I'd like to see this president's birth certificate. I don't know that he was born here. Do you?
I'm going to just assume that when you put your ticket in the hat to say that you want to run for president, that there's a massive amount of background checks going on to make sure that wouldn't happen.
Yeah, but it was never good enough when Obama was running. It was never good enough. And for years, the charade went on about him not being, his birth certificate not being valid. Well, at least he produced one. He's the only president who's ever produced a birth certificate.
I gotta think that they would produce it to whatever organization does the background check for the guy to become president or gal.
Well, there's no background check. The background check is the American people.
As
long as you meet the constitutional requirements, being 35 years of age and a natural born citizen. But there's nobody.
But how would you verify that?
Well, there's no verification mechanism. That was the whole thing that why he got to do the charade about Obama. Well, he said, release your birth certificate. Then he did. Then he said, it's a fraud.
Right. And there was a mainstream media person, CBS Dan Rather, maybe somebody went on and purported that whole thing, and then they got jammed for it. Is that right? Did I call
that
one right?
I don't remember Dan Rather. He's been gone for a time. I don't remember him being involved.
Okay. I could have a couple stories mixed up anyway. Closing things out, we got two more to go. And so here's a sex offender who visited Decatur school sentenced to 24 months probation. He goes to a school to attend a function. I don't know that they even said what it was. This happened in Georgia. And he didn't get the proper permission to go to the school. He says that he has a relative that works there, and he thought that that person had cleared it. But he shows up at the school, and then that raises a big stink, and he gets 24 months probation to just go try and attend a function at your... It could have been a PTA meeting at 8 o'clock at night, and I can't really imagine there's a whole lot of kids running around the school at 8 o'clock. It doesn't say what it was.
Well, was he spewing radiation?
I'm intrigued because you brought that up a couple times, and I don't know what the mechanism was that brought it to anybody's attention. I haven't seen that in a couple of these articles, and I'm intrigued by that.
Yeah, I can't.
But he admits to it.
A registered Decatur sex offender who broke the law by visiting a child school without getting official permission was sentenced to 24 months.
So maybe they're aware of his status, and they know that he should be. When he showed up, they knew he hadn't gone through the process.
Well, I can tell you this.
To let the principal know.
This actually is not from Georgia. You do have a Decatur, which is in DeKalb County, but it says assistant Macon County State's attorney, and they don't refer to him. Decatur is in DeKalb County.
Okay, but then there's a Macon County. There's a Macon County, Georgia, too. That's why I thought this was Georgia.
I don't believe so. They refer to the prosecutors as district attorneys. I don't think this is Decatur, Georgia, but nonetheless.
Interesting.
The defendant did not get permission through the proper channels. Wow.
There you go. So yeah. we can maybe call this the title of the story. Go to school to attend a PTA meeting and end up with 24 months probation. Maybe that'll be the title of the episode tonight. I guess I could look up where Parsons Elementary School is. That could be where we go. Well, yeah, I just wanted to bring that up as being like, go us. Here we go again. And our final article is federal judge orders state patrol to maintain status quo, keep juveniles off state sex offender registry. This is something that you wanted to cover where I think the situation is you get convicted in another state as a juvenile. And then when you go to Nebraska, there's a conflict of whether you're supposed to register or not. But in fact, you actually don't have to register. Did I pull that one right?
Until a subsequent state court. And thank you, Hank, for bringing this up to our attention, because it's a fun one to talk about. The Nebraska conflict is that Nebraska, like many states, doesn't register juveniles if they were adjudicated as a juvenile, unless they were handed up to adult court. Nebraska doesn't register juveniles. A lot of states do. So when a person moves from another state to Nebraska, the federal judge and the federal courts had determined in a case not very old that since Nebraska doesn't register juvenile adjudications, that it stands to reason that they don't have to register under Nebraska law, although Nebraska law doesn't have any specific thing dealing with out-of-state juveniles. Well, that got turned upside down by this next article, which makes several points. And I love the points it makes. And like I said, I really appreciate this article being brought to my attention about this. In a case decided by the Nebraska Supreme Court just on July 27th, a couple of months, 2 months ago, they said, well, not so fast here. You had a Colorado sex offender who was adjudicated as a juvenile, but apparently they do disclose them and they have to register in Colorado. I'm not sure he was disclosed in Colorado. I didn't get that deep into it if he was on the internet, but he was certainly required to register as a result of that juvenile conviction in Colorado. He had been working in Nebraska for about 2 months before he got himself in a barroom brawl, which as a general rule, I would suggest if you are working in another state where you might have to register, you probably ought to not get into barroom brawls and have the police called. That would be my advice. But nonetheless, he didn't follow that advice. He got himself into a barroom brawl, and the police ran a check, and the NCIC dutifully did its job and said he was registered as a sex offender in Colorado. So they arrested him for failing to register. in Nebraska. And he took a plea. He negotiated a plea for an attempt to violate Nebraska registration. He got 270 days in jail and some sentence. And then he had a change of heart. I guess he became aware of the federal decision that said that that those who were adjudicated as juveniles didn't have to register in Nebraska. And he said, well, for appeal bond purposes, I should be, based on this decision, I should get an appellate bond. And I think even the Nebraska State Patrol told him he didn't have to register anymore because they were interpreting the decision from the federal court to not include him. When the Nebraska Supreme Court said, well, now we don't see it quite that way. By golly, we think that since he was registering, he was being required to register in Colorado, which is under Nebraska's definition of Nebraska revised statutes for Hank, if you want to look this up, 29-4003, that's where they define a sex offender. And they define a sex offender among, we would take too long to go over it, but anyone, the final paragraph, who enters the state and is required to register as a sex offender under the laws of another village, town, city, state, territory, commonwealth, or other jurisdiction of the United States. Nebraska Supreme Court said, wow, well, it looks like to us that that's black letter law, meaning that you look at the, you can read it, there's no ambiguity. Anyone right. who enters the state who's required to register as a sex offender, and he, everybody agreed he was required to register as a sex offender and registered in Colorado, that he would meet the definition in the statute. And they said, we're not a bunch of damn judicial activists here. We can see what the black letter says. And it says that he should have to register under our law. And we don't get to make the law. We are the, just, we wear black robes and we interpret it. And it, by golly, it says it right there. So therefore, right. he has to register because he meets that definition of a sex offender. And they said, you can give us all this mumbo jumbo you want to about what other states have decided. But our long tradition of interpreting the law of Nebraska is that we look at the literal words, and that would be consistent with a Justice Scalia. Don't know so much about Kavanaugh. I haven't read enough of his decisions, but this would be a Scalia decision. But by golly, I'm looking straight at it, and I'm looking square at what it says, and it says a person who enters a state and is required to register, and by golly, he entered a state, and he is required to register in another state or jurisdiction. So he's covered here. And they said, if you want to be exempt, then you need to do what they did in Kentucky, because the Kentucky Supreme Court came up with the same decision on a similar set of facts. And they said, since Kentucky doesn't register juvenile adjudications, the legislature went back and they modified that section to make sure that they made it clear that a juvenile enters a state with an, from another state who has been adjudicated as such, and that other state doesn't have to register in Kentucky. But they said, by golly, they're smart enough to put those words together. And that's their job. And if they want people in Nebraska to be exempt that were adjudicated as juveniles, they need to tell us that. We're not lawmakers here. That's a perfectly rational decision to come up with if you're conservative, literal, interpret the words, give them their ordinary meaning. That is exactly the decision you would come up with. I don't like it as an advocate for what we do. I like the federal interpretation of the Eighth Circuit a whole lot better. But that was them deciding what they thought a better public policy would be. And I didn't think that, that's what judges were supposed to do, is to decide what a better public policy is. They're supposed to interpret that law, by golly, just the way it's on the paper. And that's what they did here.
And you brought up something earlier before we were recording about the, that people think that the federal judges have more power than the state judges.
That is correct. This creates a real conundrum, because the federal decision has the authority of being binding case law all over the Eighth Circuit. But now we've got a new situation, because the state court, which is the final authority on state law, unless there's a constitutional issue of a federal constitutional nature, they said, well, that's your opinion. And our opinion is that the black letter law is damn clear, as far as we can see, that people who are adjudicated as a juvenile, if they enter this state and they're registering another state, now if that other state has already exempted them, if they didn't have to register there, then they wouldn't have to register in Nebraska. That would be solid consistency there. But the Nebraska Supreme Court is saying, we're going to interpret our own statute a little bit differently. And they are the final interpreter of Nebraska law, contrary to what people think about the federal courts, as long as they cannot assert a federal claim here of a federal constitutional nature, this will supersede what the federal court has said.
That is so interesting to me. While I was gone, I read the Constitution. I found that the 10th Amendment was very interesting to me, and it says that the federal government shall have no powers that which it was not given by the states. To me, that means that the states are more powerful than the federal government, just that the federal government can assert authority in certain areas, I guess, is the kind of the backwards way to work into it. So what you're saying is that the states can do what they want to do as long as it doesn't violate what the federal constitution is, wherein they'll step in and push back. But otherwise, the state has the final authority of what goes on in their state.
That is correct. And cruel and unusual punishment, for example. A state can give somebody a ticket citation. That's a $10 fine for doing something. Another state can give somebody 5 years in prison for that exact same offense.
And you couldn't make a constitutional argument, really, because that's what it was.
Unless you can say it's cruel and unusual, which is a tough standard to meet, because cruel and unusual was, if you look at the colonial times, there was a lot of things that people did. And if you, by golly, you don't believe that thing's a living, breathing, and it evolves, and there's a standard of standards of decency evolve. If you believe, we look at literally what they were thinking back then, things that were acceptable then would be what a conservative literalist would restrict themselves to. They would say, well, the death penalty wasn't unconstitutional because it was widely used in colonial times. So it can't be unconstitutional. It can't be cruel and unusual because the framers of this beautiful document were quite well aware of it, and it was widely practiced. So it can't be unconstitutional.
You would have to come up with something that's just like extreme torture of dismemberment and being like just living in a bath of poo before you would find something that would be cruel and unusual back in those times.
It would be tougher, except they didn't sentence people to long prison terms back in those days. And that to me, I think, is the courts have let us know, like life in prison without parole is becoming more and more problematic. It's become very problematic for juveniles. They've held over and over again, you can't do life without parole for juveniles. And life without parole is an extreme punishment. So we may actually get some traction, because in colonial times, they didn't sentence people to life without. They put them in the guillotine. But they didn't.
Yeah, if you did, yeah, sure. Or some firing squad, whatever, right.
But people didn't go away for the rest of their life to be caged. That's a relatively new phenomenon.
I do find that fascinating. I'm pretty sure I agree with you that they didn't send people away for a long time. The most egregious crime, you may have gotten like, I don't, maybe a year or 6 months or something like that. And then you were just like, well, hey, just, you know, good luck. Don't do it again.
Well, I don't know.
But it would have to have been miserable prison conditions. They would have been miserable conditions.
Yes. And the tolerance for prison conditions has actually gotten conditions are being tolerated after the Prison Litigation Reform Act of the late 1990s. The difficulty, it's more difficult to successfully litigate against prisons.
Do you have any evidence to the prison strike and all that? Have you heard of anything being done to make changes to the prison systems in the United States?
Unfortunately, I have not.
Okay. I was listening to a clip and they had a guy. Yeah. He'd been fasting for 7 days and he's been 5 days without water. And somewhere around there, you start pushing the limit of what your body can handle at the 5 days. You can go 30 days without food if you have water, but you can only manage a handful of, like, maybe it's a week without water.
I didn't even know you could go that long. I didn't know. I thought it was three or four days you'd dehydrate and pass on.
Yeah, exactly. And so he's gone five. I was thinking maybe you could make it a week, but good grief. And then to have nothing come out of it, good grief. It makes me sad.
I'm not sure that prisoners are taking all that seriously.
Clearly they're not, but they can't vote. So you would have to get your family outside to vote, to do something, to call in and so forth.
I mean, we've had major, major violent prison riots in this country where lots of people died. Attica and then Santa Fe. I think Attica
and then
was
there
first.
Was the one. Yeah, and then there was the one a year ago, the Lee Correctional Facility in South Carolina. That happened about a year ago.
How many people died in that one?
13, I think, and another 20 or something pretty well injured.
Because I think it was 33 in New Mexico, and I'm going to do a quick Google on Attica, how many died. But it was we've had some significant uprisings, and change has been slow to come.
And then I did forget about one article that I had loaded in another window. It's an opinion piece out of the Washington Post. Formerly incarcerated Americans face tough odds. The farm bill could make them even tougher. And we touched on it earlier. And here is, they're going to current law, which expires this month, denies SNAP benefits only to those found guilty of a violent crime who violate their parole or their terms of their release. And so here we are, violent crimes. Most sexual offenses are listed as violent crimes, as far as I know. Now you won't be able to collect any sort of food stamps. That sucks. Go farm bill.
Well, I think the House has already passed a significant expansion of the prohibitions that are already in place on people convicted of crimes. The Senate has not, and folks, I don't follow the federal system as closely as I probably should, but just not enough time. But I believe that eventually a compromise will come out, which will be additional restrictions. And it's tragic because in this country, particularly those of you who claim that you're God-fearing and all about forgiving, I don't know how we could deprive a person of nutrition assistance because of a mistake they've made if they're otherwise eligible, if they are released and in the community and they're hungry and fit the eligibility guidelines economically. I don't know how you could look yourself in the mirror and say, we won't give you that $194 because you made a mistake. Shame on you.
It totally feels like that would cascade to the next level. Okay, so now the person's hungry. Well, where are they going to get the food? Oh, I know. They're going to go grab something so they can go rob someone's house. Oh, I know. They should have thought about that before. Okay, great. Now you want to do time travel to go back 5 years when the person made the original mistake. Oh, okay, great. What are they supposed to do now? Oh, now you want to lock them up for a violent crime. So now you're going to pay $30,000 or $50,000 a year to keep them locked up. Great. That sounds like an amazing model.
It is. And like I say, shame on you. Shame on you for not calling your senators and your representatives and saying, I'm outraged. And I find this revolting. Of course, a lot of people don't know about it because it's not widely. You have to work to want to know about bad public policy. It's not something when you get up in the morning that you're going to check the congressional action and see what's under consideration. The average person's not going to do. I don't do that. But this is widely known about the push to make more and more people ineligible for public assistance. And it's widely supported. Drug testing for people who are on unemployment benefits. Drug testing for people who are getting Medicaid. By golly, if they're smoking that funny wacky weed, they'll not get any help. Really?
Funny wacky weed. Your terms are funny.
Well, that's what it was called in my life, was that wacky weed.
Okay. I mean, I guess in the 1900s they called it that.
Well, doesn't it make you wacky if you smoke it?
I really can't personally attest to it. I cannot personally attest. I do not remember. I smoked it twice and do not have any idea. Like, it just, I don't know, my throat hurt and I liked lights. That's it.
Did you inhale it?
As far as I know, but I don't know that I did it well. And I was 15, so I can't even really say that I did it well.
Did they have wacky weed when you were 15?
I don't think it was. I don't even know what it, I can't call. I don't know what to, I didn't know what to do with it. No idea. I'm not a drug user. No idea. The economic margins for the formerly incarcerated are narrower than many of us can imagine. Median annual income after release from prison is about $6,500 a year, effectively a state of deep poverty. Today, around 70% of those released depend on SNAP 2 months later to survive. That says $200 a month benefit make up more than a third of their slender means. Mm-hmm. It's just being crappy on top of crappy.
It talks about who we are as Americans.
I agree.
I get criticism for saying that, but I keep saying it because I'm hoping that one or two people will pick up the phone and say, yeah, I agree with Larry. We shouldn't be. That does not represent our values. And if one or two people do it, maybe one or two people more will do it. And it doesn't take as much to drive public policy as you think it does. If there's a town meeting of your U.S. representative, and three people ask about why are we prohibiting people from having nutrition assistance because they've committed a crime at some point in their life, that will make its way back to the halls of Congress. That representative will start thinking about that, saying, well, are we really doing the right? My constituents are speaking up about that. It doesn't take 100 protesting and doing an office sitting. It takes two or three hands going up at a town hall meeting to say, I disagree with this representative.
And that's how the votes come down. And then maybe they have influence over another politician. And then, you know, either the bill gets stalled or it gets voted in your favor, something positive in the direction that we're trying to move things. And it doesn't matter which jacket, red or blue.
I'm for good public policy. If Republicans want to join me on this to say we're wrong, we should not be restricting. Of course, I know that they won't because they're the chief sponsors of this. But if they want to join me on this, I will give them every kudo I possibly can and every platform I can find.
But this, I'm with you.
This is one of those things where it's conservative driven. It's that anger, get the taxpayers mad and convince them that they're being taken advantage of. And yes, there are programs that get taken advantage of. Everything where there are public monies in it, whether it be selling military machinery to the government, or whether it be paving roads, or whether it be direct transfer payments, there would be some opportunity for abuse, whether it be defrauding on your tax returns and claiming exemptions for things you didn't actually, for deductions for things you didn't actually do. We're human. And yes, there may be some fraud, but we shouldn't turn our backs on giving people nutrition aid who otherwise are eligible. To me, that's un-American. That's un-Christian. I can't think of enough ways to describe it.
It's inhumane, really.
Well, I guess I could go that far. And I've strongly object to it.
I also then would then extend that to healthcare benefits, too. I think everybody should get at least some level of basic safety net of healthcare and not using the emergency room when you have a hangnail. That's just stupid.
So, well, there again, we're the only industrialized modern country that doesn't have a universal system for healthcare. And believe it or not, they don't all hate their country's healthcare systems like what you hear on the news. The average Canadian is very happy with their healthcare system. The average German is very happy with their healthcare system. Are they perfect systems? No,
nope.
They're not perfect. Ours is far from perfect. But if there were all these people were so dissatisfied, they would be in those democratic societies of Germany and Canada and Great Britain. They would register that resentment at the polls.
Right.
But we get a lot of that. Well, you know, in Canada, you have to wait 34 years before you can have a CAT scan. Because they only have one machine per every 100,000. I mean, you hear that. And there may be some truth in that. Our system tends to over-allocate because people want to administer those tests for profit. And they charge 5-10 times as much as other advanced nations do for the same procedure. And I'm not really an expert in this. I just know anecdotally what I've read for years and years of my life. I've looked at this. And healthcare is so much more expensive here for similar procedures.
Yes. Yes. Very much so. Very much so. Well, great. Another podcast where I feel so much better after we've talked. Well, that's all I have, Larry.
Well, then how do our wonderful supporters get in touch with us just in case they have forgotten since earlier in the podcast?
Sure. There's always the email, which is registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You could leave voicemail, which we absolutely adore, at 747-227-4477. You can also send text messages. We can talk back and forth if you want to do that. The website is registrymatters.co. And of course, the best way to support the podcast is at Patreon, patreon.com/registrymatters. And if you're interested in the Discord server where we could chat, you talking about doing a live stream here coming up, probably. I'm thinking about we're going to do it on our 50th episode because that'll be roughly around the 1-year anniversary. And if you would like to participate in having the show sent to you live when we record it, we'll be working on getting that information out when that gets closer to the time frame.
And what do we give our $1,000 a month supporters when we start signing those up?
We could give them whatever they want. Just make the request and it'll be done. It'll be delivered as if on a red carpet.
We've got some nice supporters and
we do.
Can't say thank you enough for it's just such an honor to be appreciated to the level that people are expressing their support.
It's pretty stellar.
It's humbling.
It is. I agree with you. That's a perfect way to word it. And with that, I will be signing off. Thank you again, Larry, as always, and I will talk to you soon. Bye.
Good night.